You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today for our June 2026 mid-month book news check-in, where we go over the latest Asian American book and publishing announcements. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you can gain access to our members-only Discord server, where we can chat with us and fellow members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly Patron's Choice book club pick, which our devoting period for next month book club pick should be live right now on Patreon. So if you want to have a voice in what we read for our July book club pick, you can do so by joining our Patreon today. But yeah, Rira, how's it going? It's the beginning of summer. Things are getting hot. The World Cup is going on. I know that you are enjoying is probably not the best word because yesterday's.
I had a good time. I mean, like I'm not someone who like gets really angry when it comes to sports. I was really excited because it was Mexico versus Los Angeles. Los Angeles, sorry. It was Mexico versus South Korea. And as someone who lives in Los Angeles, it's a really big deal. There were a lot of public watch parties. There was like a huge one in Seoul International Park in K-Town. There was also like a huge one at The Source in Buena Park. And it wasn't just like the Koreans who gathered there. It was like Koreans and Mexican fans. So it was like a big party. And I just love that because, you know, we're pretty much neighbors and we both like to drink and party. So yeah. It was like a really great block party. I wanted to go to a public watch party, but I was really scared about parking and also taking public transportation. Because the game was at 6 o'clock and it's like a 90-minute game, I was like, I don't want to be stuck on the metro at night with like hundreds of people. It just doesn't seem like a fun time. And also I wanted a good view rather than be blocked by like a bunch of tall football boys. So what happened was like I brought out my electric grill and my friends and I grilled KBBQ at my house while we watched the game on Telemundo, because Telemundo does not like cut away during hydration breaks for ads. So also like I heard from the grapevine, I don't know if it's true, but I heard that some of the English speaking sports commentators were saying stuff about the Korean team wearing purple jerseys. They were like, oh, like,
really?
That's not going to be popular amongst soccer fans. And it's like, oh, it must have been difficult for them to, you know, don that color for the game. And I'm just like, okay, it's just a color. And also it's sold out within an hour. It was a very popular jersey kit. And I was also like really frustrated because people who are into like Korean culture, they're like, yeah, it's purple because of K-pop Demon Hunters. Like Rumi's hair color is purple, or it's purple because of BTS, because that's BTS's color. And I see like Koreans being like, I'm so glad you guys are into like K entertainment, but actually it's because our country's national flower is, you know, like the shade of lavender. And it's actually really important to us because the Japanese, when they colonized us, they try to get rid of our national flower. And, you know, like purple is also like a very important color. In terms of like Korean history, like we're known for amethysts as well. So it was like, I'm seeing comments on threads and people being like, I'm just going to pretend that it's just for K-pop. It's for BTS. And I'm like, way to minimize our culture just for your Delulu Entertainment.
Yeah, I feel like people don't understand that K-pop Demon Hunters is actually a very Korean American project and like film, and not necessarily like, you know, it did open up the mainstream to K-pop, but it's not like, it's not as like South Korean as people think it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's just annoying because like someone is taking the time to explain like cultural significance and they're like, that's boring, I just want like my fun idea of it being for BTS, and I'm like, okay, let's just
watch the internet
football.
These days people just want to, they want to believe what they believe, and as long as they can find someone else to back that up, that's all they need.
Did you watch the game, by the way?
So 6 p.m. is a tough sell for me because my kids nighttime routine starts at 6:30, so I was able to catch the first like maybe like 20 minutes of the game before we had to take our kids up for bath time and then bedtime. So I was able to catch like the first 15 minutes and then got to catch the last like 20 minutes. But I was keeping up on the discourse on Reddit and other live chats. And overall, I think it wasn't a very exciting game. I did see the goal that Mexico scored, and it was a very like, I feel bad for that goalie. That was a,
yeah,
that was
like
a big mistake.
It brushed his hand, so it's like it's not like he like completely failed, it was just like a
I mean, he caught it was just unfortunate. He dropped it, like it's yeah. A drop, that was the thing, like he should have held on to that ball, or else that should have never been able to like if he had held on to that ball, it would have been, there would have been no chance to score, so that I think that was, yeah, a big mistake.
I always feel for goalies though, because it's like it's such a high pressure job and people are just so quick to hate, and you know, like some of my Korean friends were like really mad about that, and I'm like, dude, calm down, okay? Like he did save multiple goals, and also we're not even in like the thick of the competition yet, we're in groups, like Korea is gonna make it to the next round, like their last game is with South Africa, we are definitely gonna move to the next round. So it's just like, oh man, I'm not an avid soccer person, but also I'm just like, I feel like some people just really, they don't go here and they think that they can just dictate all the things that went wrong, and it's like, okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's more, sure, the goalie made a mistake that caused the goal, but also the offense wasn't really firing neither. Like it was
Korea
had no offense. I mean, we are not a soccer podcast or football podcast, but I have been watching World Cup almost every day for the last week. It is very exciting, and the games have been overall pretty good. I just, you know, I wished Mexico Korea, for all the hype that led into it, would have been a more exciting game. But
everybody seems so tired, and I was like, what is happening? But the great thing about watching the World Cup has been watching like the smaller countries who like have never been to the World Cup, like really having their moment. And yeah, also my favorite content right now is just like all the Europeans and Japanese fans who are in like middle America or like Boston, and they're just like enjoying American culture, and I'm just like, wow, I'm so jaded by America. I feel like we have a toxic, abusive relationship with our country that is like, oh, there's actually good stuff here.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really enjoying that too. I love that the World Cup being an international game with very passionate people, like it creates this cultural exchange, right? And I also love the side stories coming out of it as well, right? Like Scotland drinking all the beer in Boston, and then the Japan, they're in Texas right now, so they're all enjoying their barbecue. And you know, there's a story of how like, oh, the Japanese fans are so respectful, they clean up after themselves. But have you seen the backlash from back home on that?
Oh yeah, they're just like, oh, if they can do that, they should probably pick up around the house. And I was like, okay.
I love that, like, I now have context for that too, with like, since we read Butter by Asako Yuzuki, since we read like Kim Ji-young, like I know there's like that backlash in context of like the feminist movements in a lot of East Asian countries right now, like, it all makes sense, right? This is the type of thing that those books were talking about, just like, yeah, it's all performative, and
if they wanted to, they would, and they're not doing it at home.
Yeah,
and yeah, I think they have every right to be mad about that. So yeah, it was very interesting to see like that dichotomy of like, Americans being like, wow, look at them cleaning up after themselves. Like, they're so respectful and, you know, cleanly. And back at home, they're just like,
let the women
come on, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but yeah,
it's like, you can do better.
And we're not here to talk about at length about World Cup. Well, we might talk more about World Cup at the on our next Boba Chats. So maybe stay tuned for that. But we are here today to check out the latest Asian American book and publishing news. So as always, we start off our podcast by highlighting some of the latest publishing announcements from Asian and Asian American authors. This list is compiled by Rira through sources like Publishers Weekly and social media. So as always, thanks to Rira for putting this list together. And yeah, let's get started. Rira, what is our first book deal?
All right, so our first book deal is Mira Won World Rights to Life as a K-Drama by Emmy Award-winning actor Sherry Shepherd and author J.C. Lee. The duo's first collaboration is a contemporary romance about a divorced single mom in Harlem whose chance to turn her neighborhood restaurant into a household name is upended by an unexpected spark with a swoon-worthy Korean business magnate. Release is planned for April 2027. So J.C. Lee, I'm pretty familiar with her work. She is the author of Nine-Tailed and Give Me a Reason. She's also a romance author. She's like, I've featured many of her romance novels in our romance selection on our bookshop.org affiliate page. So this is very much in her area of expertise. And I'm guessing she, you know, spearheaded this story since this is her profession, whereas like Sherry Shepherd is an actor and a comedian. So
yeah, Sherry Shepherd I think is also a TV host. Like, she was on The View for a couple of years. I think she has her own talk show now too. So it is an interesting collaboration. And by, I mean, just by the context, it sounds like it's going to be like a Korean dude and a Black woman type of romance, which is a fun combo too.
Yeah. And I love how it's like, they're both bringing in their own perspectives from their own like racial communities into the story. So it's like, it's pretty much like coming from an authentic source.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely screams like romance setup and also like K-drama setup, right? Like, I feel like there's a lot of like K-dramas and webtoons. They're all about like the aloof, rich CEO who falls in love with you know, quote unquote, a commoner, right? Someone like a regular person. And like, you know, I wonder if this is going to be one of those things where like he's like the magnate who's trying to buy out her neighborhood and she like introduced him to the culture of Harlem in New York.
Yeah. I think it is like leaning more towards that. And, you know, we're against gentrification. You know, we've been getting a lot of stories like that as well. So yeah. I'm glad that is part of that canon of, yeah, let's not gentrify everything unique about our neighborhood. So congratulations to Sherry Shepherd and J.C. Lee.
Yeah. All right, next up, Hogarth has secured North American rights to two novels by Sao Ichikawa, who was on the long list for both the International Booker Award and the National Book Award as well. The first novel, Ophelia No. 23, is a provocative and formally daring study of misogyny, art, and performance in the age of AI. That book is planned for 2027. And the second novel, A Girl's Spine, is a story of two sisters with the same disability and their fraught relationship. Publication for that book is slated for 2028.
So Ophelia number 23 came out in 2024 and Girl's Spine came out in 2025. According to this book news, I don't think a translator has been assigned yet, but Sao Ichikawa is a pretty well-known Japanese author, like contemporary Japanese author, I think. We're getting more translated works, which is always great, because I'm actually pretty surprised because those two titles are very recent. I feel like there's always like a longer buffer when it comes to translating works in East Asia. So
I feel like that lead time has reduced significantly in recent years, because I do see a lot of like publishing announcements and publicists reaching out for a lot of translated works that are like more recent. I think especially if you're a well-known author, those translation deals they're in the works even before your book is even published. So definitely, I think, you know, I think these days people love like literature, love media are more open to reading and also watching like foreign media, right? We got a lot more films from Korea, from Japan, where like people are willing to read the subtitles if it's like the new Bong Joon-ho or the new Park Chan-wook film, right? In the same way with literature, the new like Asako Yuzuki joint or the new who's the vegetarian author? I forget her name.
Han Kang.
Yeah, like I feel like there is more of a hunger for those types of books as well. And you know, looking at Sao Ichikawa's biography, she is also a disabled author and is known for having disabled representation in her literature, which I think is also really cool coming from like a Japanese author.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. All right, next up, Penguin Workshop bought in a 5-book deal, Birchwood Prep, a middle grade boarding school series by May Ray Specio. The series follows five friends as they navigate time-honored seasonal school traditions, juicy drama, and meaningful self-discovery. In book one, Lena's Secret, Lena must find her voice and figure out her act in time for a harvest showcase before her secret catches up to her. The first two books are set for summer 2027, with book three to follow up in spring 2028, book four in summer 2028, and book five in spring 2029. So May Respicio is the author of The House That Lou Built. And I think there was like one that was like fairly recent, Isabel and Bloom. So this is not her first rodeo when it comes to middle grade novels.
But a 5-book deal was very, it's very impressive. That's like your next like 5 years. Like,
yeah, yeah. Right? It's pretty great. Yeah, that's a great deal. And growing up, like I freaking loved reading books about boarding school. And I remember like daydreaming about it. It's not just because of like Harry Potter. There was a time when there was a lot of books geared towards girls who like were interested in leaving their parents' house and having this sort of independence that you can get at like a fancy prep school. So I'm really glad that like that subgenre is making a comeback.
Yeah, I mean, boarding school, coming of age boarding school stories, I think it's a very classic type of genre. I can't say if I read those books growing up. I definitely read a lot of manga and watched a lot of anime with this specific setup as well, right?
Yeah, I remember a lot of those books being geared mainly towards girls because the main characters were girls who were from like quote-unquote commoner backgrounds, and they're going to this very fancy, rich prep school. And I think the most common, like most popular book of that subgenre was Prep by Curtis Sittenfield. And like, I remember freaking loving that book to death. Like the paperback just like fell apart. I know Looking for Alaska was also like a boarding school story, and that one was geared more towards boys. So yeah, it's a whole thing. It's a very coming of age classic, like yeah. Marvin said.
You know, it's a classic for a reason. So like congrats to May Respicio on her 5-book deal. That's still very amazing. So yeah, looking forward to learning more about those as they come out. But yeah, next up, Knopf Make Me a World has acquired world rights to Kapa Kuiki, My Hawaiian Quilt, a picture book written by Ima Kahokuilani Todd and illustrated by Mae White. Set against the backdrop of 19th century occupied Hawaii, a girl learns the art of Kapa Kuiki, or quilt making, from her grandmother in an act of revolutionary practice, protest, and resistance. Publication is scheduled for spring 2028.
I love how like fiber revolution is like a whole thing in history. Like I know that like during the Jim Crow era with the Underground Railroad, they would like do secret messages in quilt making. So yeah, it's all fiber art has always been part of, you know, of like revolution and resistance.
Yeah, and also, you know, symbols of culture, of heritage, as also symbols of resistance. We were just talking about the color purple and Korean flowers as like a memory of like colonial resistance in World War II as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like, I mean, quilt making, knitting, crocheting, mad respect for people who have the ability to do so because it's difficult. And I feel like it's a skill that used to be passed on from generation to generation, but now with like the advance of like sewing technology and just other technological advancements, like the old traditional ways of like making fiber yeah. art has just kind of fallen to the wayside.
Yeah, and you have to appreciate combining the history lesson of like the origins of the state of Hawaii with this book about a cultural practice, right? Teach the kids about the coup, right?
Yeah. And also, I'm pretty sure the art's going to be gorgeous because quilts are always like really beautiful in terms of their patterns.
Yeah.
All right, so our next book deal is Penguin Nancy Polson Books bought world rights in an exclusive submission, All the Gardeners, written by Varsha Bajaj and illustrated by Grace Easton. The picture book is an ode to all growing things that explores the concept of humans and nature being gardeners together. Publication is set for summer 2029. Again, mad respect to the people who have the ability to grow things. and gardening, because let me tell you, I don't have like a backyard, but I do have two lime trees and like a big flower bush in like my patio area, and you know that's our responsibility, and it's so hard, you guys. I think you either are born with a green thumb or you're not. I just feel like it's something that you need to have a natural ability to be able to be good at it.
Yeah, I have not tried my hand at gardening, so I don't know if I have a green thumb or a black thumb. I don't have a backyard either, so I can't really, you know, haven't really grown anything yet. But definitely,
I know a lot of like elderly Asian people who like, even though they don't have a backyard, they have like their little balcony plants, they're little terrace plants, so they like grow tomatoes and like cucumbers out of like pots.
Yeah,
and I'm like, I can't do it.
I mean, if it's something that you want to do that you're good at, like it's a great way to also, you know, be a little sustainable, to save some money, you know, if you have the time. Yeah, and that, you know, a lot of it's also just understanding the science, understanding the relationship with nature that creates the, you know, the environment for things to grow and thrive. And you know, some people it just comes easier, and I love that this is a book that can teach your kids that, like, hey, you too can grow things, maybe.
Yes and or just appreciate gardeners and people who have the ability to grow things if you're not able to do it yourself. So
it
sounds like a really cute picture book.
All right. Next up, Crown has bought world rights to Sufu Mama, a picture book by Roger Lam and illustrated by Lena Chow. The book follows Hao Hao, who is preparing for his first Kung Fu tournament and learns from Mama that the true meaning of Kung Fu is not about high kicks and strong punches, but discipline, patience, and practice in everyday life. Publication is slated for spring 2028.
I think that's really cute because the Sifu is the mom. We're so used to like the grandfather Sifu.
Yeah,
like imagery.
Yeah, and I think it's a good lesson that, like, you know, learning martial arts isn't about learning how to fight. It's learning how to, you know, be disciplined, be patient, and like better yourself, right? Martial arts is about self-improvement and self-actualization, especially if it's kung fu, because like kung fu tournaments, I don't know if you've ever been to like a wushu tournament or something, but like,
nope,
it's not really a lot of fighting going on. Like Chinese wushu, Chinese kung fu is more similar, it's closer to dance than like combat sports, right? It's not like taekwondo is definitely like they're sparring in the tournaments, but like with like Chinese martial arts, it's more about like routines.
That makes sense. Yeah, I would say like kung fu is very dance like from what I have seen in like kung fu movies.
Yeah, I remember taking kung fu when I was a kid as well, and I would say it's closer to like taking a hip hop class than like a karate class.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
All right. Our next book deal is Penguin Workshop acquired world rights to Bamboo Magic, a picture book written by APALA award winner Teresa Robinson and illustrated by Waza Pink. Following Kay and her Popo as they make stops around Hong Kong, the story celebrates a rich local resource whose versatility in everyday life is quietly remarkable, bamboo. Publication is planned for spring 2028. Bamboo is used for a lot of things, and going back to gardening for a second, bamboo shoots are almost impossible to get rid of. So if you plant bamboos, you better be sure that's what you want, because they you can't get rid of them.
Yeah, but it's also a very sustainable wood, right? That's why
have a lot of use them for construction and cooking, and
you can make cutting boards out of them. You can use them for there's just a lot of ways to use bamboo. You can also eat bamboo before they get too big, right? When they're still shoots. It is a very magical plant. So definitely cool to have a book to teach our kids, like, you know, bamboo is much more than what pandas eat.
Yes.
All right. Next up, Red Comet Press has acquired world rights to Kung Fu Crane Girl by Mia Wenjin, illustrated by debut artist Yu Jie Huang. The picture book is inspired by the legendary girl believed to have created karate. Publication is set for fall 2027.
Another martial arts picture book. What are the odds, you know?
Yeah.
And it's also Kung Fu.
Yeah, I did a quick Google search on White Crane Kung Fu, and there is a style called Bai He Quan, which is White Crane Boxing, which was developed by a female martial artist that I guess did influence Okinawan style karate. So yeah, it's really, I learned something new today, and I'm glad that there's a book here teaching the hidden histories that we don't see.
I mean, like, look at all the Kung Fu movies that have been popular in the West. It's been mostly like Kung Fu Boys or, you know, like Jackie Chan. So, yeah, definitely love seeing more female representation in martial arts.
Someone should make this movie. Like, tell us, give us a biopic of the Kung Fu Crane Girl.
Yeah. All right, our next book deal is FSG bought in a 3-book deal in an exclusive submission, Boss Games by Kelly Yang. The standalone middle grade novel follows 12-year-old Everly Chow, who is desperate to save her family's restaurant business. When a tech billionaire announces a competition to design the future of food, Everly sees the contest as a way to change their lives for the better. Publication is scheduled for winter 2028.
I'm immediately suspicious of this tech billionaire. It's like at my core, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, Elon Musk became the world's first trillionaire, like, this past week. Yeah. And I'm just like,
don't trust him, Everly.
It's getting worse.
It's a trap. It's not what you think it is.
It's a trap. But Kelly Yang, we've had her on our show before. We've read her book, The Take, for our author interview. You guys can, like, go back a few episodes to listen to that chat. We've also read her debut novel, which was a middle grade novel, Front Desk. So, like, she's going back to writing middle grade because The Take was her adult debut, which, let me just say, The Take was unhinged. Like, I really enjoyed reading that book. So I highly recommend people to go check it out.
Just a prolific and very talented author, and someone who has been, you know, in the trenches fighting, you know, book censorship, and, you know, fighting a good fight, which is why I have confidence that, like, this book, you know, even though it does feature a tech billionaire as like a exit plan for the main character, I feel like it's gonna have the right messages, right?
Yeah, like, watch Everly win the contest and her drawing idea, design, whatever, gets stolen and used to make a lot of money, and none of that money goes to her. Capitalism is definitely going to be a theme in this book.
Yeah, so always excited to see a new Kelly Yang book, and congrats on the new book deal. All right, our last deal of this episode, Picnic Heist has bought world English rights to 2 picture books by Han Bui. Both books will be illustrated by Carissa Green. The first book, 8 Little Hands, is about a Vietnamese girl finding new ways to spend time with her hardworking grandfather as they adjust to life in a new country. That book is slated for fall 2027. And the second book, Flickers of Hope, is about a child who takes comfort in her grandmother's stories of home as she navigates her first night at a refugee camp. That book is slated for fall 2028.
So I'm wondering if the author Han Bui, this is based on her grandparents' stories as refugees, because we are now at that point in the publishing industry where, like, second, third gens are coming forth with their family stories about war and fleeing their country.
Yeah, and I really like the fact that, like, both books are, you know, they're about, they're stories meant for kids about through the eyes of a kid going through the refugee experience, right? Both in the refugee camp and also after they arrive in the States and having to build a new life. And I like the fact that we get both a grandfather and a grandmother story as well.
Yeah, it's a great way to honor both grandfather and grandmother.
Although if it is based on someone who was a girl during, or someone who was a child during the refugee camps, they would be probably the age of our parents now.
Yeah, that would be correct. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that is a wrap on book deals, and we're going to move on to book news. So our first piece of news is that Marjan Satrapi, the author of Persepolis, died at age 56. So Marjan was born in Tehran, Iran in 1969. And, you know, even though she grew up in a communist leaning household and studied abroad in Vienna and France as a young adult, the 1979 Iranian revolution and like the aftermath of it, you know, obviously had a big impact on her life. So she wrote about her adolescence in the New Islamic Republic. And, you know, wrote about rebellion, exile, return, and permanent departure in her comic Persepolis. It was published in 4 French volumes between the years of 2000 and 2003. And it's been translated into more than 20 languages. And in 2007, Marjan co-wrote and directed an animated film adaptation of Persepolis. And that won the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival. And it also earned her first Academy Award nomination in 2008. So we lost a titan. Like her work was very, I think Persepolis was like the first work I came across that portrayed how women were dealing with the aftermath of the revolution in Iran.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading Persepolis a long time ago. Like, I think I was in college when I came across that book. And it was definitely one of the first, like, I guess, own voices accounts of that time period that I read about, you know, Iranians during and after the revolution. And I remember it stuck with me because it was like, this was like a time before, like, you know, now we get a lot of people talking about the Syrian Civil War and the Vietnam War, where like more nowadays, more people are writing about those times. A lot of times it's the next generation writing stories of their parents, right? But this was one of the first examples of like that type of narrative, that type of storytelling that I came across as well. And I remember I worked at Sony Pictures when Persepolis was being released on DVD. So I think I'm pretty sure I have that film somewhere in my collection back home. So I never got a chance to watch it, but it's the DVD is sitting in my shelf somewhere.
The animation is pretty great. And I come across like clips from the film on my Instagram reels quite a lot. So I mean, take that what you will about my algorithm, but yeah, like it's, you know, its themes on like fighting the patriarchy is always, you know, it's always a theme that I love seeing in media. So RIP to Marjan Satrapi.
Yeah, definitely rest in peace. It's definitely, I imagine it was a hard battle to get this book published, get this book out there in a time when like not a lot of people were doing it, right? So sad that we lost a trailblazer, but if you haven't checked out Persepolis, definitely take some time to pick up either graphic novel or the film. They're both great ways to kind of see the voice that we lost.
Yeah. All right, so our next piece of news is Taiwan Travelogue won the 2026 International Booker Prize. So we read Taiwan Travelogue a couple months ago,
yeah,
for book club, and It was like, I think we had a really good conversation on just like, on like translation and like Taiwan's history with being colonized by Japan and just like microaggressions that the Taiwanese dealt with under Japanese colonial rule.
Yeah. Another book also that has like East Asian feminist undertones as well, right? Like
we were on a roll
streak.
With that.
We were on a streak, yeah.
Yeah, but Yan Chuangzi, the author, who, you know, if you've read the book, she's also like, it's kind of meta. So like, you think that she is the translator of you think that they are the translator for the book when they're actually the author. their acceptance speech was pretty poignant. I'm just going to read little excerpts. Taiwan's people have endured multiple colonial regimes and faced threats of invasion. When confronted by geopolitical forces so much greater than our own, what use do we have for literature? I have always believed that literature wields power. Literature appears slow, but acts with steady resolve. Translation allows writing to transcend the limits of time and space. I believe in literature's power because in the life of the mind, literature has never ceded ground, nor given up on the dialogue between people.
Yeah.
I think we really, like, the timing of us reading this book for book club was truly...
Yeah, I think Chinatown Travelogue was my pick. And, it was just a book that was... All the other book clubs were reading it, and I was like, that sounds really interesting. You know, my family is nominally... It's diaspora is weird because, like, my parents are from Taiwan, but my grandparents are from China. But I think, identify with Taiwanese culture more because that's where I spent a lot of my summers growing up. But at the same time, also, the people that Yang Xuanzi was writing about in Taiwan Travelogue is not my people neither. But, like, we can all, like, I think as diaspora, as minorities, as, like, people who are living under, you know, capitalism and colonialism even today, like, we can all, there's a lot of things in that book that we can relate to, and also just the food descriptions were just very, very good.
Yeah. This book, it kind of reads, so when I say that this book is meta, it's framed as a rediscovered memoir written by a Japanese author who is doing a 1930s food tour in Taiwan. And it's like, yeah, it reads
it's a
as
book
like
playing a dude pretending to be another dude, right?
Yeah. And then it like gets translated quote unquote by a later translator in our current time. So yeah. lots of layers to this work, but I just love how it's like a cozy read, but at the same time, there's just like this maliciousness that's kind of like swimming underneath the cozy and delicious food descriptions. And it's like,
yeah,
I hope when people read this book for the first time, they catch that rather than being like, oh, yeah, it's a feel good book about traveling and eating in Taiwan. And it's like, it's not that. It's not just that.
I mean, so we did discuss this and definitely listen to our book club discussion because we go into detail. But I think the ability for the reader to catch that hinges on their own lived experience as well. And I feel like that is evident because the book itself has a fake foreword by a fictional scholar that actually tells you to approach the book with colonization and imperialism in mind for those of you who like were not aware of these things, right? And I remember when we read it, we were like, we didn't need to be primed. Like we caught the subtext instantly. But there are definitely people who needed to be primed because they don't have that like colonial radar that like a lot of us have as like a defense mechanism.
Yeah, I'm really curious because this was written in originally in Mandarin, and then it got translated to English by Lin King, which is the version that we read. Like, what is it when they get translated to Japanese? Like, how does that work into like the lore of this book?
They're gonna have to create a whole different like meta backstory for it, right?
Yeah, because, interesting, right?
Yeah, because the book itself is a Japanese text translated into Chinese. In the meta, so yeah.
Food for thought. All right, so our last piece of news, we have some number one New York Times bestsellers to announce. So June Herr's latest novel, Behind Five Willows, which was described as You've Got Mail meets Pride and Prejudice, but in Joseon era Korea. It debuted at number one on the New York Times bestsellers list for young adult hardcover books. And then like a week later or 2 weeks later, Cindy Pham's debut novel, The Secret World of Briar Rose, debuted
at number one on New York Times bestsellers list for young adult hardcover books. And that's really amazing. It's like back to back. We have back to back Asian American.
Yeah.
Actually, June Her is Asian Canadian. I'm sorry.
I mean, I love that also, like, these two books are like so different from each other. Like, June Her, I've been just enjoying her emergence as like a bestselling author, right? Because I remember we've talked to June, I think, twice on this podcast. We talked to her twice, or was it once? I forget.
I think it was once, because we read Silence of Bones, which is her debut book for a book club. And then we interviewed her when Red Palace came out.
Yeah. And I think Red Palace was the book that kind of blew up, right? At least when we talked to her, it was before she blew up in Korea, right? Or was it just when she blew up
in
Korea?
Yeah, it was right before. Okay, so this is very funny. And I don't plan to like take like too much credit for this, but like right around the time the Red Palace had come out, a Forbes writer had reached out to us asking like, hey, I'm writing like this article where a bunch of like book publishing / literary podcasters recommend books to their, to our readers. So like, if you have a book that you want to recommend, like, please do so. And I recommended Red Palace because that was like the most recent book that I had read. And I had written like my little like micro review on it. And then the Korean press picked it up. So like the Korea Herald was like, oh my God, Forbes like featured this book by a Korean Canadian author. And then it got translated and kind of like posted everywhere in like the Korean community. And then there was like announcements. It was like timed perfectly with like the announcement of like her earlier books being translated into Korean.
Yeah.
So that was like the beginning of like her books kind of blowing up in Korea as well. Like I said, I don't want to take too much credit. It was just a coincidence.
I mean, it's good timing. I'm sure it was
the timing was good.
The timing was good. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, her books are like, we've joked about her books being like Joseon Noir, right? They're like kind of, they have, because she writes a lot of mystery. I don't think this is more of a romance.
This one's
right?
not mystery. This one's straight up romance.
Pride and Prejudice. But like she lives and breathes Joseon Dynasty, but also through the lens of like, you know, female characters, and especially like female characters who aren't part of the aristocracy, right?
Yeah. And also it's like, I'm really curious to read it because like Joseon era, I guess like later Joseon era, like it got relaxed a little bit, but like there was a big segregation between men and women. Like it was stricter gender roles, and just like women could not go out alone without like a male chaperone or just anyone who is like not their relative. So it's just like, okay, like how do the characters fall in love when they're unable to just meet?
Well, that's the you got mail angle, right?
That's the you got mail angle. So like came up with a really clever way on like, you know, building this forbidden romance in Joseon era Korea. And I say Joseon era as in like, I mean, it's like 500 years of that dynasty. I'm guessing it's like in like the early 1800s that she's like, it's like that's like the Regency era, right? Regency England. It was 1811 to 1820. I just looked it up. I was just like, it's in the 1800s. I just don't remember when the Regency era in England was. But that would fit right in with Joseon era in like the 1800s.
An era of gender and class norms. Yeah, definitely a prime background for a Pride and Prejudice. And I think it's really cool that like a book that maybe 10 years ago, you know, at the eve of our podcast would have been seen as like a niche Asian American title can like also reach the number one in the New York Times bestsellers list. That's pretty impressive. And the same with Cindy Pham's book. You know, this is her debut. She is a prolific booktuber. And, you know, I think, you know, her book is probably more like consistent of what I would imagine as a New York Times bestseller, you know, like dark, gritty, romanticy type of book. But it's also a really good one of those though. So definitely like well deserved for Cindy as well.
Yeah. I mean, we talked with Cindy Pham like recently about her debut novel and also her YouTube career. And when it was announced that it debuted as a number one New York Times bestseller, she posted on Instagram. And, you know, normally when authors like post like, oh, I reached like the New York Times bestsellers list, it's like very celeb, like it's very like joyous, right? It's like, oh my God, we did it. But then her caption was so well written and like so thoughtful. So I'm just going to read like parts of it. She wrote, "I have mixed feelings about bestseller lists. I think they promote unnecessary competition and comparisons between authors, which I actively avoid. They also conflate book sales with merit. When the world is not a meritocracy, and art should not be defined by numbers or even universal likability. The Secret World of Briar Rose became an instant number one New York Times, USA Today, and indie bestseller because it has the benefit of a big publisher supporting the book and the author being internet famous for her lowbrow rants about fairy. But these lists also act as cultural amplifiers, and they shape conversations, trends, and voices. And I'll also recognize this. An openly queer Vietnamese woman became a number one New York Times bestselling author, with the agent being Vietnamese and the editor being Pakistani and the cover artist being Filipina. So it is like a very big milestone. And I think she's right on the money when it comes to New York Times bestseller lists or bestseller lists in general.
I mean, awards in general, rigged. Too, right? Like,
yeah,
just award season in general. It's all pay to play if you dig deep enough.
Yeah, but not to say that it's like not worth celebrating, especially when you're a writer from a marginalized community, because the deck is so stacked against us.
Yeah.
And, you know, like when we started this podcast almost 10 years ago now, we started it in like fall of 2016,
literally a month
like we didn't get
election,
stories yeah. like the yeah we didn't get stories like these, and there was like not that much coverage as well, so
yeah,
it's nice that we have like I said, it's like back-to-back New York Times bestsellers, like they outdid each other within a span of like a week or so.
Yeah, so congratulations to June, congratulations to Cindy, and you know, congratulations to our community, because we are in the face of like more and more obstacles, we are still putting out great work, and that's always great to see.
All right, but that is a wrap on book deals and book news from mid-May to mid-June of 2026. If we've missed anything, please let us know on Discord or on Instagram.
Yeah.
There's so much that I honestly, it's a miracle getting this list done every single time, because I have to wade through so much drama. I think the most recent drama that I saw today was someone saying authors should use easier words for their readers because vocabulary can make it a very big obstacle in terms of them enjoying the book. And I just, that just blew up right before we started recording, and I was like, I can't get into this. I feel like that just
encapsulates the, you know, I think because I have kids, I'm on education TikTok too, and just like everyone's sounding the alarm bells that like kids can't read, and it's like I need to make sure my kids know phonics. That is my goal.
Oh yeah,
for the next
phonics,
few years.
Vocabulary, yeah. Context reading, because apparently context reading is something that they do not get taught at school these days.
Apparently they changed the way reading comprehension questions work.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so. And it was just so funny because like the tweet, the post that kind of started all of this, like they were like, oh, like this is the word that I didn't understand. And it was scrying. And I was like, scrying is not, I mean, I don't think that's that difficult of a word, but maybe it's because I was like a gothic teen who was really into witchcraft and
Well, also, we live in a world where Google exists. And no, if you need to go there, ChatGPT will also tell you what that word means. Like,
yeah, I mean, I used to look up words, like, if I couldn't figure it out through context clues, I had a physical dictionary, like,
yeah,
the old school kind where it was made out of a book and you had to flip through the pages.
I learned the word scrying from playing Magic the Gathering.
Exactly. A lot of if you were a nerd, if you were a geek, you would have known what scrying was. But yeah, that blew up on Threads and Twitter, and I'm just like, I can't deal with this right now. We're about to record in like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of news that I have to wade through when it comes to collecting news for these episodes.
Oh, well, at least we still have our book club. Speaking of book club, Rebecca, can you remind our listeners what book we are reading for book club this month?
Yeah, so we are reading The Chosen and the Beautiful by Ni Vo. And it is a magical realism, queer retelling of The Great Gatsby. So we are back in like the jazz age.
Yeah, if you're reading along on Discord, we have finished our read-along. So, you know, if you want to talk about your thoughts on the book, all chapters, the entire book is up for discussion now. So definitely looking forward to hearing your thoughts on this book. As always, we'd love to include your feedback on our podcast discussion whenever possible. And yeah, with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Rira for compiling our book news of the month. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We've got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.
Potluck Podcast Collective.